Hashem has tefillah. I thought it appears somewhere in our tefillah.
So it comes up in the Gemara. Vavo katzis Hashemesh b'gvuraso is brought in the Gemara when they talk about those who hear other people shame them and they don't respond. So that may be what you're thinking of. Okay, brand new story is the story of Gideon. This story is a lot of fun. It is also, as we're going to see, a lesson in miracles. Specifically, why miracles don't work. It's the classic question that you hear people ask all the time. If only God would fill in the blank, or even just, if only God would do a miracle, any miracle, I'll take anything, that would prove that that there's a God, and then I would believe. And that's utter nonsense. And the story of Gideon, I believe, is meant to demonstrate exactly that miracles don't work. I gave you the outline of the section in number 6 here. The story begins with the Jews living under oppression by Midian. We'll talk about Midian, of course. Then there are a few psukim about divine rebuke, followed by Gideon having an encounter with someone who is either a malach or a navi. We'll have to talk about that. After he has this encounter, which includes a miracle, he then is given a mission. He has to destroy his father's altar for idolatry, which he succeeds in doing. Then he has a second miracle that is given to him, and then a second mission, which is to assemble an army to fight Midian, but to make it a really, really small army. And he does that. And then he has a third miracle. He is introduced to the Midianite camp where he witnesses from outside the camp one of the soldiers talking about a nightmare he had about the Jews defeating them. And that gives him a sense that God is on his side and a sense that they're going to be victorious and that the morale is low in the Midianite camp. And then he goes to war against Midian and he's victorious. And then everything goes south. The people of Ephraim are angry because they weren't called to the battle. They go out and they pursue the enemy and have all sorts of problems in that pursuit. And then ultimately it seems like there's a descent at the end of Gideon's life, unclear if he's still alive or not, a descent into idolatry. It's a mess. The story of Gideon unfortunately does not end well. So the themes here are going to be miracles, certainly are going to be front and center. Division among Jews is going to continue as a theme, and the general decline of the Jewish people is going to continue as well. So we need to introduce Midian. We have seen so far that each enemy the Jews face carries some kind of message for the Jews. So Aram were the idolaters that Abraham had left behind in Lech Lecha. Moab were the selfish ones who split off from our nation with Lot. The Plishtim we didn't really talk about because I'm saving them for when we talk about it with Shimshon. Canaan are the immoral original residents of the land who split off from the Semites. What about Midian? So who was Midian originally? Who's the first Midianite?
Says here Keturah.
Well, Keturah's son, right?
Right.
Keturah's son. If you take a look on your sheet, you see it. I brought it in first number 7. Right. It's actually this week's parsha. So, very convenient. You get a nice little Dvar Torah for Shabbos out of this. Vayosef Abraham v'yikach isha ushma keturah. Right? Abraham, after Sarah is dead, after Yitzchak is married off, he gets married again. He marries a woman named Keturah. And everybody who was so impressed that Abraham was 100 years old when Yitzchak is born, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because this is 40 years later. And lo and behold, Keturah produces Zimran, Yachshan, Midan, Midian, Yishbak, and Shuach. And they all have kids as well, as you see. But Midian, which I bolded, is the one who we're focused on, obviously. And Abraham gives them a bunch of gifts and says, go away. I don't want you messing around with the inheritance that's due for Yitzchak. So he sends them Kedma el Eretz Kedem. He says, go east. the it is unclear to me. I've looked into it before. I've never found a really solid read when it says to the sons of the Pilav Shim of Avraham, he gave Matanot. Does that mean that there's actually more? If so, why did we list Keturah? Why didn't we list all the Pilav Shim? And that feeds into the Medrash that Keturah is actually Hagar. But there are a variety of explanations for that Pilag Shim.
It says Vaikach Isha.
Yes.
Does that make her a Pilag Ish?
Right, that's part of the problem. Is she a Pilag Ish at all? Isha sounds like he's marrying her. And then the question is, well, then what's Pilag Shim? Does that mean there was an Isha and there were Pilag Shim? Like, it is not at all clear.
Hagar is not mentioned here. Hagar had probably more than just Ishmael with Avraham.
Why?
Last week's Parsha, it only says Nahar, and if you read Ishmael as being 17 during all these events, it's a little difficult.
I mean, everybody I've seen assumes that it really is Ishmael, and yes, Nahar, we've used Nahar for people who are older. The problem isn't the word Nahar, the problem is he's also called Yeled.
Okay, but it's also the activity, carrying it. You know, sending him away, stuff like that.
Yeah, which is why Rashi says he was sick and so on. But yes, I mean, Yishmael is minimum 17 and potentially older. We only know his minimum age at that. We know his minimum age and his maximum age.
This is at what event? Was
when Yishmael is kicked out of the house. Uh-huh. Yeah. He is minimum of 17, maximum of 50.
So Hillel and both Baron have given bar tours to the
baby. Okay, but until they give me a source for saying it's not Yishmael, I'm not buying it. I've never seen a Mifaresh who said anything else.
Who's not Yishmael?
The boy who got kicked out.
Oh.
I mean, it doesn't make any sense, because the Pasuk says that she saw Yishmael Mitzachek and said, get rid of him. No, Yishmael. Chumash Bracious?
No, I trust you.
But Teres Aras Ben Agra Mitzris.
He's looking for Chumash Bracious.
No, you're right. You're right. No, it says, But Teres Aras Ben Agra Mitzris, Asher Yodol Avraham Mitzachek. The problem isn't that. The problem is in the next part of the Pasuk. I mean, the Gemara says it, so I'm not like particularly troubled. But but now I want to go see. You are right that it doesn't use the word Yishmael. He keeps calling him the Nahar. It's funny, but it doesn't. But it's par for the course in these parashios in general that omit names. So Eliezer is never mentioned as Eved Avraham, and therefore there are those who argue it's not Eliezer. But he's the only Eved Avraham we've met. It doesn't mention who the Naharim are at the Akedah. It just says Shnei Naharav. Right. But it's awfully hard to read this as not being Yishmael. I for a whole host of reasons. Where he ends up is where Yishmael ends up and so on. In any case, I can see that his name is not mentioned there in the story, but I'm still not buying the idea. In any case, the descendants of Avraham Keturah include Midian, and they are sent away to settle in the Midbar. That's our first encounter with Midian. Our second encounter with Midian is with the sale of Yosef. The question of who sold Yosef is a good discussion for some other time, because apparently everybody who lived in that region got in on the act. There are Yishmaelim involved, there are Midianim involved, there are Midianim involved. Somehow Potiphar ends up buying Yosef from somebody. But like, there's a team effort in getting him out of the pit. It's very cloudy. But there are Midianim involved in getting Yosef down to Mitzrayim. That we know. Which also makes this story very interesting, because Gideon, who's going to fight the Midianim, is from the tribe of Menashe. So Yosef's grandson is the one who's going to fight the Midianim. That's just a side note. The third encounter with Midian is with Moshe. Right? Moshe kills the Egyptian who's beating the Jew. The word gets out, and Moshe runs away to Midian, where, of course, he ends up marrying a Midianite, Zipporah's daughter. The next encounter is when Moab says to Midian, these Jews are coming to town. They're going to consume all our resources, not in my backyard. And they team up to hire Bilam, who first attempts to curse the Jews, and then, in the next passage here, to seduce the Jews. So the women from Midian, including Cozbi Basur, are involved in luring the Jews into first immorality and then idolatry. So can you identify a common thread in the identity of Midian across these different stories? I think there is one.
It was on the sideline, sort of almost next to it.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the center, there's not a war.
We don't do things directly. In other words, we cause events to happen, but we inflict it on ourselves.
That's interesting.
They're influencers.
They are influencers. I'm not sure about them being not having things happen themselves. I mean, they're recruited by Moab.
They're facilitators.
They are facilitators for sure, but they're facilitators of something specific, or they try to be, even not necessarily consciously, facilitators of something specific. What caught my eye with Midian in these stories, and the truth of the matter is, I may have an overactive imagination. And if so, guilty as charged. I think it's still Torah. Avraham separates Midian from us. He sends them away, along with the rest of their, brothers. But he sends them away. They become agents of separating Jews from the nation through the generations, so that Yosef, Moshe, and then Zimri. Right? They separate them from the Jews, and not just that, particularly involving immorality and or idolatry. So Potiphar's wife tries to lure Yosef. She's Egyptian. But the Midianim were involved in bringing Yosef into that situation, which would have been, on the one hand, immorality, but also v'chatasi l'elokim, a sin against God.
It's a little bit like we speak of Amalek.
There's a trend
of going after the weak ones.
Right, except that here they don't pick on the weak ones, right? Yosef ends up being stronger, right? And Moshe also, right? Moshe ends up marrying Zipporah as the daughter of the Kohen Midian, right? But again, he does not get lured into them. If anything, it gets reversed. And then the one who does give in is Zimri, getting drawn into Cozbi and Baal Peor. So you have this trend of separating the Jew from the herd in a context of immorality and idolatry. And that makes Midian an ideal enemy for the Jews at this stage in their national life, because they're starting to separate from the nation. The tribes are not all banding together, right? We saw that in Shiraz Devorah. They're becoming more like the nations around them, following the gods of Canaan, which is going to be a big part of the story, and the Avodah Zarah involved. I think that may be sort of the theme that is Midian. Yeah?
In other words,
I don't think there is necessarily intent.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not saying that the Midianim are conscious of this, that there's some, protocols of the elders of Midian, and across the generations they're conscious of what happened to their ancestor and they're looking to avenge it. I think that would be a bit of a reach. I think that in general in Tanakh you find certain themes repeated for particular nations that aren't the nation thinking about it. It's just their history.
We just had Yael, who is being praised, who's also Midian.
Yael?
She's Chiti, isn't it?
Chiti and Midian are two different things. Chiti is a Canaanite tribe. Midian is from east.
Isn't she somehow from Yitro?
Right, so if you're going to read which we assume, Caney as being of Yitro, then I suppose so. I didn't think about her that way. Then she ends up being vaguely Midian. I mean, they haven't been in Midian in how long? You know, Devorah is 120 to 160 years into the Jewish life in Israel, assuming that the Caney actually came in originally, which is unclear. You know, they've been out of Midian for a very long time. But you're right, technically she would be a Midianite if she's from Israel. I hadn't thought about that. Interesting. Okay.
Is part of your theory that the Midianites, the Midianim, are what you say are an ideal an enemy at this stage of Jewish history? Are you suggesting that Hashem has deliberately created this event in order to highlight a certain aspect of
yes, weakness? Yes. In the same way I felt that way with Aram and with Moab, that there's a lesson to be learned from observing who it is that God sends against you. It's more than just, here is, you know, villain of the week. There's something to be learned from them. Yeah. So, let's talk about the hero. Right? Hero slash anti-hero. At different stages of the story. But Gidon. Gidon is an incredibly complicated person. He is going to see a malach and or a navi, and yet demand signs from God. He's going to lead the Jews against idolatry, but in the end, knowingly or unknowingly, he is going to become an agent of idolatry. He will refuse to lead, but he will end up leading anyway. He's complex. And the way the Chachamim saw him reflects that complexity. Take a look at source number 8, which is the Gemara that we're going to see a lot of in Shoftim, because it comes up in a few different contexts. This, in context, is building on a pasuk involving Shmuel. Shmuel, after Shaul has been coronated as king, gives this sort of retirement speech, although he's still functioning, but he's not the national leader anymore. And as part of his speech, he talks about how Hashem has always sent the Jews the leaders they needed. And in the beginning, he says, "Vayomer Shmuel el ha'am, Hashem asher asah es Moshe ve'es Aharon, Hashem who established, who created Moshe and Aharon." And then he goes on to say, "Vayishlach Hashem es Yerubal ve'es Bedan ve'es Yiftach ve'es Shmuel." Hashem sent all of these people to lead you. Yerubal, we'll see in our parak, is Gidon. It's another name for Gidon. Bedan is apparently another name for Shimshon, the one from Dan. I have never seen an explanation I liked for why he's called Bedan here. In Shoftim, he's always called Shimshon. He happens to be from Dan and Yehuda, but I've never seen an explanation that I could really say, that's it for why he's called Bedan. Yiftach is another of the Shoftim, and then mentions himself, Shmuel. So the Gemara here says, Shakal hakasuv shlosha kalei olam kishlosha chamurei olam. Why did Shmuel see fit to bring these examples? Meaning, you have 15 shoftim to choose from, 17 shoftim to choose from. Why did you pick these in particular? And if we get to say for Shmuel, after shoftim, we can talk more about why he picked them, because there are a lot of different explanations. But what the Gemara here says is that he actually picked specifically 3 lightweights and 3 heavyweights. Moshe, Aaron, Shmuel, heavyweights. Yerubal, Gidon. Shimshon and Yiftach are the lightweights. Why does he do it? Lomar lach, to teach you, Yerubal bedoro ke Moshe bedoro. Bedan bedoro ke Aharon bedoro. Yiftach bedoro ke Shmuel bedoro. Each one in his generation is the leader. It doesn't matter that you don't like him. It doesn't matter that you say, well, compared to what we once had, he's a lightweight. He's what you got. Even the lightest of the light, doesn't matter. Respect the office, if not the man. That's the way it works. So, this is not exactly a compliment to Gidon. This is a statement of he's your show fate, like it or not. That's the statement. And then the Rambam in the Mora Nevuchim talks about the miracles that Gideon witnessed. Yeroi Ali, it appears to me, She'inyan Gideon v'giza v'zulasa omnam haya b'mar'eh. He says, the whole business of Gideon and the wool, which is one of the miracles he experiences, it's the second miracle that he has, it was in a vision. He wasn't actually seeing it while he was awake. V'lo'akra'ehu mar'eh g'nuvu agamur. I wouldn't call it a full-blown prophetic vision. She'gideon lo higia l'madregas ha'nevi'im. Kol shen l'madregas ha'mofsim. The Rambam says, Gideon was not a Navi. He certainly didn't have miracles like that. It was something. What it was, he's not at all clear. Some kind of divine inspiration, dream. His role was to grasp things like one of the Shoftim. Look, the Gemara says he's a lightweight. His dream was like the dreams of Lavan and Avi Melech. That's, you know, not high praise. The Rambam is not so impressed. Abarbanel disagrees. Abarbanel says that absolutely Gideon did experience prophecy. But one of the things that has to make Gideon complex for us is the following. I told you what his first mission was. I said it very quickly, but do you remember what his first mission was?
Destroy his father's altars.
That's interesting. What does it tell us about Gideon? Well, yes, there we're going to see so many links between Gideon and Avraham. But what does this say about Gideon?
That he's given such a mission?
Well, that just like Avraham, he rebelled against his father's idol worship.
Rebelled against his father's idol worship, true, but go back a step.
He was a part of it
until now.
Yeah.
Right? Whatever was going on, odds are, and it's going to sound like, he was himself an idolater at some stage. Yeah.
Why is it necessary to say that? We could say he didn't participate, but he didn't actively destroy it. Now he's being sent to destroy.
I'll tell you what, when you read his response to the Malach, you know, we'll see. From that, I think a lot about his personality and religious personality, not just personality. Both will come through. But Gideon is complicated. I mean, in general, the Jews at this stage are complicated because, as we're going to see, they have Avodah Zarah and Judaism side by side. Not all the commentators agree with this, but it seems clear there is a form of syncretism going on. A blending of Judaism and the idols of Canaan, and that's only going to get stronger as the Book of Shoftim continues. And in general, what you get at this stage are leaders who are not as white-hatted, so to speak, as Yehoshua and Devorah. Right? From this stage forward in Sefer Shoftim, the Shoftim are harder to read in a positive light. I mean, some of them are just clearly negative. Avimelech, you know, who murders his brothers in order to get the power of being a shofate. Yiftach, who is an extremely complicated person. Shimshon, who is very hard to read. It's not like Devorah. You know, Devorah's worst flaw was that she was really proud of what she did. This is going to be harder. And, as I've said before, I hesitate to say things like this about Shoftim. First of all, they were the leaders of Israel. Second, they were involved in miracles, however you read, you know, the Rambam here on it. And third, you don't know enough about them to judge them in any way. I'm just working with what the text is giving us to work with when I say the things that I say.
Why isn't Shmuel rebuked for his pasuk of including himself in all the greats?
So the Medrash looks at this pasuk and asks the basic question, which is why is he referring to himself in third person? What's that about? You know, he's one of these, you know, star athletes who talks about himself in the third person when he's being interviewed. So the Medrash actually notes this and says that Nevi'im in general, including Shmuel, are not aware of what they are saying. It's like automatic speech. The words come out. Correct. The words come out, and they're not even aware, and that's why he refers to himself in the third person. And the Medrash only mentions, as exceptions to this, Moshe and Yeshaya, who both use the first person when speaking. But yes, there are other Nevi'im, like Devorah, who use... Yeah, the question of whether this is really Nevuah when she gives her Shira, I'm not so sure. But that's that Medrash's answer to the question of why he's speaking in the third person. Yeah, but it's not straightforward, it's true. So, how are we doing on time? I lost track because I broke up the audio.
7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay. So let's get started on the parak. Let's see a little bit. The opening six psukim are just descriptions of oppression under Midian. Vayasu v'nei Yisrael hara b'nei Hashem. Surprise. V'nei Hashem b'yad Midian sheva shanim. 7 years under Midian. Note that this is actually better, right? We had 20 years under Canaan. Only 7 years under Midian. Vataz yad Midian al Yisrael. Mipnei Midian asu lahem b'nei Yisrael as hamin haros asher b'harim v'es hamin haros v'es hamin tzados. Midian's hand becomes very powerful over the Jews. Because of Midian, the Jews end up creating minharot in the mountains, as well as ma'arot and mitzadot. So ma'arot, we know, are caves. Mitzadot, a mitzuda, is a fortress, some kind of reinforced area. That's why Radak renders it here. Minharot is a very interesting word. What is the word nehora? You know? It's Aramaic.
Visible, or?
Nehora is light. Right. Nahara is light. So Minharot, according to Rashi, is a hiding place illuminated via some hidden way to let in light. According to the Malbim, it was a warning torch that they would use to let them know when Midian was coming. But it has something to do with light.
What was the first?
That it was some kind of a hidden area with a little bit of a gap to let light in. That they would use for illumination.
Today, Minharot are tunnels.
So that's coming from this.
Yeah.
But it's interesting about, yeah, they're not using the light reference. But that's what the Jews do. They go underground. V'hayam zara Yisrael, because what would happen? If we planted, or when we planted, v'ala Midian, v'amalek u'bnei kedem, v'alu alav, those people to the east, Midian, Amalek, and those easterners, they would come in and attack. They would take all of the stuff we produced, all the way to Aza, in the west. No word on the Plishtim and what they're doing about this. They didn't leave food, they wouldn't leave a sheep, an ox, a donkey. Kihemu miknehem ya'alu, they would come in with all of their stuff, v'ahalehem, and their tents. Uvo kidei arbela rov. They were like locusts, which is a term we find a lot in Tanakh when you describe an invading force. Vilahem v'ligmalehem ein mispar. They came with innumerable camels. Which is very interesting, because like camels is not what I would have thought of. But they're raiders coming from the east, from the desert area, so I guess they got camels. Vayavo baretz l'shachasa, they came to the land to destroy it. Vayidal Yisrael ma'od mibnei Midian, and Israel became very poor because of Midian. Vayizaku v'nei Yisrael el Hashem, and the Jews cried out to God. And of course, that's your turning point, is the Jews crying out to God. A couple of notes here on this passage. First of all, this mirrors what was predicted in the Tochacha, right, in Parshas Kisavo. You're going to plant things and the enemy is going to get it. That's number one. Number two, in terms of the Jews and their behavior, the verb in the beginning of this section was Vayasu. So Rashi quotes you a Medrash Tehillim, which picks up on this, because elsewhere we said Vayosifu. They continue to do bad. Here it's, and they did. So Rashi, in source number 10, quotes you a Medrash Tehillim to say that they had a fresh start. Devorah brought them back. They did everything right. And now they've started being bad again. But it's not by Yosefu, because there's been an interruption. Devorah succeeded in getting the Jews to go straight. That was source number 10 on the sheets. The last thing that I would note on this is the role here of Midian and the B'nai Kedem and Amalek. They're desert dwellers, right? They live east of the Jordan. They're raiders. And they come in to attack and to take whatever they want and go east. So I don't remember if this was my own idea in my notes or whether I got this from someone else. But I suggested that they might be emboldened by our success. In other words, as far as they're concerned, we came out of the wilderness, moved into the land, fought a bunch of wars, won, and settled down. So they may be saying to themselves, that's a neat trick. Let's try that too. Except they're not settling down. They come in, they fight, they take what they want, and then they go home. Maybe they have a vision one day of having like a set place. But they're emulating what we did, and we enabled it because we weakened the local Canaanite nations.
Why does it say that their purpose was to destroy the land?
Right, so destruction here doesn't have to mean destroy as in burn it down to the ground, but they take everything. And we use that term also with locusts in general. They destroy, but of course they're eating it. It's not burn it to the ground, it's take everything away. Yeah. Good. All right, so God willing, next week we'll pick up from here.